Welcome to Let's Jaws for a Minute, the podcast which takes a deep dive into Steven Spielberg's 1975 classic film Jaws, minute by minute or thereabouts. I'm Sarah Buddery.
And I'm MJ Smith. And we don't have a guest this week, so it's just us. And we are talking about a scene. The timestamp for the scene is 52 minutes and 24 seconds to 53 minutes and 31 seconds. And in this scene, it's right on the heels of, obviously, the scene we talked about last week, but Brody and Hooper have anxiously and angrily delivered their case to Mayor Vaughn about shutting down the beaches for 4th of July and dealing with the shark problem that they have. And Larry, with anchors on his suit and dollar signs in his eyes, refuses their request. And where we left off last week, Hooper is done. He, his last line, I think, was, "That's it. Goodbye." Mm-hmm. And he's just very over Mayor Vaughn. Well, this week, Brody talks Hooper down from the ledge at least a little bit and appeals to his logic brain, kind of, you know, gets them both grounded back in reality, gets them, tries to shake them out of their anxious and angry states. And so Hooper respects Brody and tries to appeal to Larry's logical higher thinking and basically breaks down that the vandalism, the sick vandalism on the public service message of Welcome to Amity Island is a sign of the anxieties that the citizens of Amity are feeling, that they are actually scared of the shark, and also that the proportions are correct on the vandalism. Mm-hmm. And Larry, instead of saying, "Oh yeah, I hadn't considered the human factor in this," says, "You'd love to prove that, wouldn't you? And get your name in the National Geographic." And then he walks away. And then Hooper descends into madness, at least for a little bit. It just breaks Hooper. So after that, Brody goes and tries to appeal to Larry on his own. And Larry basically says, "No, we are opening those beaches. Do what you can to make the water safe, but those beaches are going to be open and tourists will be here." And then he drives away, and that's the end of the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had some pretty strong words to say about Larry last week, and I feel like that will probably continue into this week's little bit as well. And I did want to mention right at the top, I only noticed it right before we started recording, actually. Something just cropped into my brain where I was like, I feel like this is another of those sneaky Spielberg long takes that we've brought up quite a bit. But because I sort of spliced this scene into two, we lose the effect of it slightly. But I did go back and watch the sort of beginning part of this scene, mostly just to check that I was right, but also it's great, so any excuse to watch it again. But yeah, right from the start of this, so from the start of what we talked about last week, as they're sort of walking along before the billboard even comes into shot, that's kind of the beginning of this shot, and it doesn't cut until after Hooper sort of descends into laughing madness, and when Brody then walks away to try and reason with Larry. So that, I believe, is when we get the first cut. So it's a really long take. I think it's about 3 minutes, maybe just over, actually. I've not got the timestamp from last week in front of me, but it feels quite long anyway. It's certainly more than a couple of minutes before we kind of get a cut. And one thing that I noticed about this bit of the scene that we're talking about this week is, as well as it being sort of the tail end of this very, very long take, it's quite an unusual camera angle. It feels like we're very low down and we're sort of looking up at them. And the effect this gives, well, it's an effective use of camera placement, as we have the impression of the billboard looming over them, certainly at least when the billboard is in shot. And even when Hooper sort of like backs away and points at the shark, the camera doesn't move even then. So Hooper just becomes this like head in the background talking about the proportions being correct, which is quite funny and odd to look at as well, just sort of staying in this fixed position. But what came out to me as why this is so effective in having this billboard looming over them is there are two things sort of looming on the horizon of this film, if you will. They are the shark and they are the 4th of July regatta event that's coming up, basically this holiday weekend for Amity that is the next day, as we find out 4th of July is tomorrow in this film's time frame anyway. So yeah, these two things that are looming over Amity are both represented on this billboard. Now that it has been vandalized, this public service message telling everyone to come to Amity and have a lovely old time has now got this shark drawn on it. So this effect of having that be the thing that is still really strong in this scene, and the characters are, we're sort of looking up at them and the billboard, I think is super effective. And I don't think I've really picked up on that before, or certainly the significance of it anyway. But yeah, that was, I think, the first thing that really, really hit me in this scene.
Yeah, that angle's weird. And it's really weird because it's pretty subversive in that usually when you shoot someone from a low angle, it's because you want them to loom large in the frame, like they're the most powerful thing in the frame. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's usually the opposite. So if you shoot someone from above, they look a lot smaller and they look dwarfed by their surroundings, which gives them less power. And here it's used, it's almost sort of like a forced perspective, Peter Jackson, you know, Lord of the Rings type of move to make them look so small compared to this billboard. And this billboard is looming over all three of them, really. Like, yes, Larry is the one actively doing the sabotaging of what's in the best interest of the people of Amity here, but because Brody and Hooper, especially Hooper, right, he's, like you said, just kind of a floating talking head. Hooper has zero power in this town, really, like when it comes down to it. And so they're all kind of powerless against this, but Larry's the one who's the most in the frame, and he's the one kind of throwing his weight around a lot, making sure that the beaches stay open. And yeah, it's just really interesting to take something that usually makes, you know, figures in a frame look really powerful and use it to make them seem actually a lot weaker than that through the visual storytelling. And there's actually really good visual storytelling throughout this scene. I don't know if we want to talk about it now, but kind of towards the end of the scene, there's like a street sign.
Yes.
In the so background good. That is really great. I guess I'll wait until we talk about it deeper in the scene, but I've never noticed it before. And I was just like, oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
So, and then there's like a crazy happenstance where the wind is just kind of hitting Murray Hamilton's hair, and it's forcing this like spike in the blue of the sky that makes it look like a shark fin to me, like, because he's got gray hair. And I don't think that was manufactured. I think that was just happenstance, and it was like, hey, that's kind of great.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's just really neat touches all over the place, and it's one of the few times we're not focused necessarily directly when these three are talking on just their faces. We're taking in a lot of information. Until this point, Spielberg's kept it pretty tight on their interactions. And now he's, you know, filling the frame, the background of the frame behind them, with a really prominent, you know, brightly colored, large piece of art that's looming over them. And so there's still excellent like reaction acting that's happening amongst these three, but it's harder to take in now. It just feels like they're being swallowed by this problem. Like they're being completely engulfed by it now. And even their little micro reactions that are, have made up the bulk of their interactions so far get lost in this, this problem that's just, you know, really getting out of hand fast.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention about this particular low camera angle being quite subversive, given that it's usually something that makes a character seem more powerful or larger or whatever it is. Another thing that it does is we've spoken about a lot previously in the person who is on the right hand side is the person who has the power in the scene, and Brody is in the power position, if you will, and just because of the camera angle and where he is stood as well, he appears a lot sort of like physically larger than Hooper, so you would anticipate that he is the one who has the power in this scene. And I guess he does in a way, because I think that in this dynamic Larry is gonna listen to what Brody has to say more than what Hooper has to say, but turns out Larry is not gonna listen to anyone. But Brody is silent for the most part, so again, that's really interesting, and I don't think that's something that we've seen previously. If we think about the dinner scene when Hooper sort of like barrels into the Brody house, he is sat over on the right hand side and he very much steers that conversation, being in that power position. Another example, when Larry confronts Brody on the ferry, Larry is on the right hand side of Brody, and he very, very clearly has the power in that scene, as he is sort of, you know, laying it into Brody then about not worrying about this shark and everything else. So super interesting to sort of see that three shot again of these characters, and naturally thinking that Brody will be the person who holds the power in this scene, but really the thing that holds the power in this scene is, this is going to sound weird, but the background and the stuff that is happening in the background. And because of this weird camera angle that they've chosen, not only is the billboard this like looming presence, but also that sky is like really, really blue. Maybe this is just because I haven't left my house in a long time, but it looks so inviting, and you're just like, the weather and the fact that this is going to be like a really hot, glorious, sunny, blue skies weekend, that is an issue for them as well. That is something that is going to affect what happens next, because the hot, sunny weather brings people to the beaches. Naturally, you're going to have tourists come into the island anyway, but all the locals are going to be out as well. When the weather is not nice, people are not going to the beaches. And people's behavior changes when it's hot as well. Maybe this is just a UK thing, because we don't really get that much hot weather here. You're in California, can't relate, because it's hot most of the time. But
it'll get 112 in the summer here.
Yeah, I don't know
Fahrenheit,
what that is in
Fahrenheit. We're not bursting into flame.
I don't know what that is in Celsius, but that sounds hot. Here we'll get like, I don't know, we had like a one sunny day like a couple of weeks ago, and it was quite unseasonably warm for April. And like, I was just driving to my local shop and I see some like an unnecessarily shirtless man, and I was like, really, this is behavior that is, you're not on a beach, you're in stains. Like, you don't need to be walking around with no shirt on. And everyone just, you know, wants to be in a pub garden, on the beach and whatever. And yeah, at the moment, not necessarily a good thing to have people gathering in these places. The hot weather at the moment means people are outside, and you know, we're still in the midst of a pandemic, so not a good thing. But yeah, getting back on track before I distract myself talking about the weather like a true Brit, that is gonna be a problem as well, in the fact that the weather is like so nice, and the temperature and everything else is so ideal, this is a problem for these people. There are going to be more people out and about, and that is sort of, yeah, very, very clear in this scene, the fact that what is actually taking over this frame or this particular shot is is this billboard and all the things that represents, and just generally how nice and pleasant it all looks. And it's a weird choice, but it really works, I think, for this scene, and particularly when we know what happens next, which is the boatloads of tourists arriving. You're just starting to feel dread. it's creeping in slowly, I think, at this point.
Yeah, by the way, 44.44444 degrees Celsius is what that is.
Too hot.
Yeah, so that's how hot it gets in my neck of the woods. And yep, and it's to the point where, like, anything less than 110 or 43 degrees is manageable in the summertime. Where it's like, oh yeah, it's not too bad. At least it's not 110. It's 106.
It's all relative.
Yep. Well, we could have it way worse. It could be 110. It's only 106 degrees here. So, yeah, it is. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the weather being a problem. That's a really good point. And especially in light of the pandemic, it's weird. You know, we've talked about how the movie hits different in the pandemic. This section especially, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't prepared for that. I don't think I'd put two and two together on that until we are now on the precipice of this section of the film. But this is the section that feels, I think, the most like current times. I just watched The Host, the Bong Joon-ho movie.
Oh, that's
a
good film.
Stephanie Meyer adaptation. Yeah, I'm writing a paper on it for school, and so I had to watch it for that. And it was super interesting watching it and just seeing how much of that film feels like Bong Joon-ho's Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things that feel like Jaws in that movie. It was crazy. I had never noticed. I've seen that movie a handful of times too, and I've never put two and two together. I'm like, oh, there's a lot of Jaws references, and even kind of the pacing of it. I want to say it's about as long as Jaws. It's right around the 2 hour mark. It's got a pretty simple setup with a big attack at the very beginning almost. You know, the creature's in it a lot more. You see the creature a lot more than you do in Jaws, and it's certainly, I would argue, less up to interpretation over what the shark represents, or the creature in The Host represents. But anyway, all that to be said, it was also really interesting because a plot point I had forgotten about The Host is that they mention that people who have come into contact with the monster are getting a new type of virus and they have to quarantine, and everyone is wearing masks and they're getting mad at the doctors for not wearing the masks, even though they're saying there's this virus. And then late in the film, you find out that the government's been lying about the virus so that they can use this new chemical weapon on the monster, but also it like starts to affect the people of Korea, and they start like bleeding from their ears and coughing up blood and stuff when they're exposed to this chemical. And it was just so interesting because it felt like a simpler time. And I know that sounds dismissive and reductive as an interpretation of the film, but it's so interesting because you watching it in the middle of the pandemic and then being like, oh, there are people who actually think that about real life right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really weird to just be like, this feels really weird, like in the middle of the pandemic, to be like, oh, there are people who think that the government is lying about the current virus we're dealing with so that they can do experiments on the people. And, you know, it was just really weird watching that movie because I don't think Bong Joon-ho feels that way about COVID at all. Like, that's, it's sort of not the point. And, you know, the interpretation of that film is about basically about how America has a complete disregard for any country not named America. And but the larger implications of that was just, it was really weird just being like, oh wow, this is the exact type of misinformation, even though it turns out to be true in the film. This is the exact type of misinformation that's been going around about the current situation we're in. And it just feels like way different. It was just a weird vibe watching that movie right now. And that's how I felt about this. It was really interesting watching this scene, having just watched The Host last night at the time of recording, and being like, oh, this feels exactly like the pandemic that we're in currently. And this doesn't feel that far-fetched because we're living in it.
Yeah, it hits different, I think, particularly the next sort of few weeks in episodes that we'll be talking about and breaking down, because you then sort of see what is the result of those in power kind of not listening to the scientists or logic or reason or anything like that. And it's hard to watch, and it's a different kind of dread now, I think, that you feel. And like this, I've always felt dread watching this particular scene and last week's as well, because you're just seeing a man, and this is Larry we're talking about, you're seeing a man so blind to the truth that it's it just becomes hard to watch, I think, because I think we said last week, it is just like watching a train crash happen very, very, very slowly. The train is coming off the rails and nothing we can do to stop it at this stage. And we feel as helpless, I think, as Brody and Hooper feel in this moment. And I, particularly Hooper as well, I love that laugh so much. It's just so,
it's so good.
It's so maniacal, but it's so relatable as well. Just that kind of like, all you can do is laugh. And I have certainly felt like that at times during this pandemic, when I think you just see wrong decision after wrong decision being made and horrible consequences as a result of that, very real consequences. But sometimes just some of the things that happen are so bizarre and so wild, you honestly just can't help but laugh at them, because it's like,
yeah.
I mean, our Prime Minister just constantly comes out with like the most insane things, like truly, truly deranged things that make sense to no one, I feel, and paints this picture of sort of like the lovable idiot who can't even run a brush through his hair, let alone run a country. And it's not you kind of do have to laugh, because there's nothing else you can do, really. But also just seeing such an inept leader, as we see in Larry in this moment as well, it's just like, oh, this is just, it's just hitting that little bit too close to home at the moment as well. And I want to give props to Hooper in this scene, because as we said last week, and you mentioned at the top as well, he is done. By the time we start this scene, he is like walked away. That's it. Goodbye. Like, he is over it. But Brody talks him off the ledge and brings him back into the conversation. And he very calmly and in real layman's terms as well, lays it all out for Larry as the sort of last ditch attempt to get him to see sense. And then it is completely thrown back in his face. And honestly, the way Hooper reacts, I feel like I would react in that way, too. Yeah, just same. That disbelief, because what else can he do? He has just stood there and said, you know, this is... it compares a shark to an engine or a machine, and really trying to get onto Larry's level, and he's not throwing the Latin at him or the science or anything like that. He is just like, think of this shark like a machine. It is programmed to do one thing, or, you know, several things, and that is eat and make little baby sharks, and, you know, I can't remember the exact quote. Let me find it. All this machine does is swim and eat and make little sharks, and that's all. And then obviously he, you know, mentions about the proportions on the billboard, and that seems to be the thing that gets under Larry's skin, and he, you know, flips on that. But it's just, I don't know, so frustrating when it's spelled out that clearly, and yet Larry is just having absolutely none of it. It's hard to watch, I think now, but I still do love this scene a great deal. But when it is hitting as close to home as I think it is at the moment, it makes it that much harder, I think, to sort of watch these decisions happening that you know are going to have really horrible consequences.
So something I'm learning over the course of this show is that Richard Dreyfuss is super taken for granted in this movie, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever realized how great, like how truly incredible his performance is in this movie. Like, I've always loved his character and I've always loved Hooper. And, you know, we've talked several times about how Hooper is probably the most relatable character for us. And that's true. But he makes so many good decisions over the course of the film in how to react to stuff and how to read certain lines, but it feels so natural coming from him that it completely disappears. Like, I feel like I have not ever truly appreciated the craft of acting that he is working with in this film because of how much he hides it. And I mean that in the best way possible. Like, it just feels so natural to him. Like, it just feels like, you know who Hooper is. I've met Hooper. I am Hooper in certain situations. And that's exactly how I would react, or the person I know who's like Hooper would react. But looking at it now, like on a week-to-week basis, especially now that he's in the film a lot more, and obviously having seen the movie a million times and knowing what's going to come with Quint and their, you know, tumultuous relationship, just the way he sets up those dominoes for, like, he just plays the long game so well. Mm-hmm. And we're watching it pay off week to week.
Mm. Yeah, it's so good. I was honestly torn in this scene of, like, who it gives the better performance out of him and Roy Scheider. I think they're doing very, very different things in this scene, so easier to sort of, like, separate them in that sense. But yeah, I am always for giving Richard Dreyfuss all the credit for how great he is. I think he's a super underrated actor as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that what he delivers in Jaws is probably up there with his finest work, if not his best performance, because like you said, he does just make it look so natural and just makes these choices in his performance that I think just add so much to that character, because this character on paper, and I think you get this in the book, could run the risk of not being a very likable character. This sort of rich, college educated city boy, know it all. Like, that on paper sounds like all the things that I would really detest in a person. But it's just something about those little things that he puts into the character. And I think it's the things that we've been picking up on recently as well, like the way he sort of keeps cleaning his glasses, and that's just like a thing that he does, and it generally comes before he delivers this kind of truth bomb, but it's also, you know, just one of those Hooperisms. And the way that the character, and then obviously Richard Dreyfuss in playing him, adapts the way he talks and the levels that he uses in his voice depending on who he is talking to, what he is saying, and the point that he is trying to get across. And there's a real change in his tone when he sort of really lays it out on the table for Larry in this scene that's very, very different from his tone a few seconds ago, obviously, in what we talked about last week, where he's that much more confrontational and quite angry. And, you know, he's he's taken that sort of like walking away and then he's been brought back in, and it's important that it's Brody bringing him back in as well. And we don't really hear what Brody says to him, but I think it's along the lines of like, you know, like, come on, like, please. Like, he's almost like pleading with him, like, just try this one more thing and see if that works. But to give Roy Scheider credit in this scene as well, some really great silent acting, as we would come to expect. And I just love watching his face when Richard Dreyfuss laughs. Because there's so much that you can read into his facial expressions as well. He is feeling the exact same way that Hooper is feeling, I think, that he is feeling that disbelief, and he probably just wants to laugh or cry or do something, I don't know, react in a stronger way, but he has to keep that air of professionalism. But you just see that disbelief written all over his face. And then when he sort of goes to talk to Larry as well, he's really trying to, and it's, again, this is a very different Brody from what we saw in the previous scene as well, where he was pretty manic, like, you know, circling around Larry and Hooper and sort of saying, you know, shark repellent and all these other kind of insane things. And he's really calmed now and is having had that manic state where he's, you know, reeling off all these things. He's now digesting and processing, and you see that all over his face as he is just kind of like really coming to terms with what is happening and the consequences of it as well. I think especially is what you see on his face.
Yeah, I think it is a pretty accurate portrayal of his anxieties once again, because yeah. I know when my anxiety is the best, as far as, you know, it's not really intruding in my life and, you know, dominating a lot of my thoughts, is when there's a lot of shit to be worried about, because my anxiety is like, see, yes! I told you. And so I tend to do extremely well in emergency situations because I'm very in the moment. Mm-hmm. I can make like clear-headed decisions, I feel like. And it's, once again, like I said, because my anxiety is like, this is what we've been preparing for every day of your life forever. And
we really thrived in this pandemic.
No, not so much. That felt a lot more nebulous. But like, personal emergencies, like people going to the hospital, yeah, or whatever, I'm always like, what do we need to do? I'm asking the doctor a million questions because I, you know, I'm really good at like asking doctors questions when there's like someone's dealing with a health problem or, you know, even making like big, not to bring it back to like my dad's stuff again, but like during that situation, it was like, I was the one who had the decision-making power about what we were going to do about, you know, as far as life support and things like that. And like, it was a very clear-headed, clear-eyed decision that I saw like a very like, you know, logical outcome for. And there was no mania involved with it and things like that, because my anxiety was placated. It said, hey, this is something you should be anxious about. Like everyone would say, that's absolutely a situation you should be anxious about. So I think that's what's happening here, is he crests the wave of the manic anxiety, and then the anxiety goes, oh, wait a minute, this is actually something for me to worry about. Okay, we've got this. And so now Brody is worried, obviously, still, because he knows the wrong decision is being made. But at the same time, he also knows, like, okay, because these are the parameters I'm having to operate in, I have to figure something out for the safety of the people of Amity, because that is my job. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's finally like seen it from that angle. And he's, you know, even though he's trying to appeal to Larry even more, he's very much working out like, look, I know this is probably not going to go the way that it should or that I want it to, but I need to do something. I can't just let this happen either.
Yeah, it's, you sort of see that change in him from how he was in the previous scene, and all the time that Hooper is talking as well, he is again just internalizing a lot of what he is thinking and feeling and processing, and just trying to sort of get the chief of police hat back on in a little bit as well, because the way that he was acting in the previous scene and how he confronts Larry, I think is he probably realizes that, you know, yes, he is ticked off, but he needs to try and remain professional, for not even just to appease Larry, it's for the good of the town and for the safety of the people who live in Amity, which I think is something that he does care about, and his family is amongst the residents of Amity, so of course he cares about their safety and the safety of everyone else as well. But he's very pragmatic when he walks away to, he goes to Larry as well rather than going after Hooper, which I think is significant, because he sort of quickly realizes that Hooper is done with a capital D now, like even more than he was previously. Mm-hmm. There is no sense running after Hooper and asking him to say anything else to Larry, because he tried that and it did not work. So it is only Larry now that he can try and appeal to. So he has to let Hooper walk away. And there is that great look between them after Larry drives off, where it's just sort of like, well, here we are. not really knowing, you know, what to say to each other, really. But prior to that, when he walks over to Larry to try and talk him off the ledge, I guess, or speak that sort of final bit of sense into him, I think he realizes that, you know, the beaches are going to open. Larry is going to and do what he wants to do. Yeah. He comes up with something which is pretty sensible, which is, you know, we act now and we might be able to save August, but it is, I fear, too little too late, because as we said, 4th of July is the next day. So as far as Larry is concerned, this is it now. There's no trying to do anything at this stage. You know, the people are coming and I'm not going to stop them, which is obviously the wrong thing to do. But there's something that I want to mention in what Larry then says back to Brody. And it probably, maybe I haven't read too much into it before, but now reading too much into things is exactly what we are doing on this podcast.
Yeah.
But what he says to Brody, and let me get the script in front of me so I've got it right. So he's sort of saying, you know, we're going to be open for business, going to be one of the best summers we've ever had. And then he says, now, if you fellas are concerned about the beaches, you do whatever you have to make them safe. But those beaches will be open for this weekend. This is a seriously bad behavior from Larry. It's now putting all the blame on Brody, or sort of in advance of potential disaster, now making Brody the scapegoat. And this is what politicians do, right? I mean, protect their career at all costs, protect their reputation at all costs. But it's after that whole conversation that they just had and has clearly not taken any of it on board, he is now like, okay, you think this is going to be a problem, so you need to now do something to sort it out. My hands are clean. This is on you now. And that is a lot for Brody to have to deal with on top of everything else. But now it's passing the buck. It's Larry ahead of disaster, probably deep down knowing that something bad might happen, or is there is at least a risk of something happening, is now like already trying to clear his name and being like, all right, you sort this problem out, but the beaches are going to be open. So really putting him between a rock and a hard place at this moment in time.
Yeah, Larry sucks. Man, he's so monstrous in this set of scenes that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And just like the complete disregard for anything but the town's money, like, you know, and I sort of get it, but I sort of don't, right? Like we talked about before, like, if you're a seasonal town, the rest of the money you're gonna make for the year comes in during this one season, and that's it, basically. And that's really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I live in an area of the country that would we're not even seasonal. We're like market dependent. So oil and ag, I think I've mentioned this before. Oil and ag are the two biggest supporters of our economy. Well, if oil's in a downturn, you can see it in the county. It's really hard on people. Mm-hmm. And if ag's in a downturn, or if there's like weather's been weird one year or whatever, you can see it in the county. Like it's those years are harder. There's not as many businesses opening up for like restaurants and things like that. There's not as many people going to those places. There's more places closing down. There's more abandoned buildings. Like it just gets bad. So I do understand that. I also, my dad worked in a very seasonal profession. And so it was just like the winter, really great. The summer's a little lean. Mm. So I understand the concern there. However, it's all a balancing act, right? Like, and if people are dying, what? You know, so like my dad, his line of work was, when I was growing up, after he was a musician, was he was a bartender at a bowling alley. If people just started dying to bowling ball attacks, probably would have shut the place down. Mm-hmm. And figured something else out, you know, like people. And I think that's the other thing too, is people are more resilient than I think we give them credit for sometimes, or that they give themselves credit for. And so they'll figure it out, I think, for the most part, within reason, right? Like I don't want to come off saying like, oh, if you lost your job during the pandemic, like that's on you. That is not on you. That is sometimes there are circumstances that make that impossible. And I'm very sensitive to that. And I want you to know that I understand that. And I very much want to drive that point home. Mm-hmm. However, I think a situation like this where, you know, it's not a pandemic, it's a shark, and a shark can be dealt with in a timely manner if the people who want to deal with that shark are given the resources to deal with it and the time. And once that happens, then we can get back to normal. Also, I live fairly near the beach. Those things are busy as hell until the weekend before school starts. They absolutely would have been able to save August, because the busiest time of the year besides 4th of July is the weekend before school starts. Everyone goes back to the beaches the weekend before school starts. So yeah, they would have been able to save August. Like it's such a lame excuse to me. Larry does not have a leg to stand on in that argument that August is too late. No, that's not the case at all. Because people want one last party before they go back to school.
And Larry, he makes some stupid decisions, but he seems like quite a shrewd businessman, at least. So, and we sort of see it in the next scenes as well, where they start to kind of capitalize on the shark attacks, where they have like the shark souvenirs for sale and all that sort of thing. So accept that this is a problem that right now you need to deal with before there is more death and more injury or anything else. This is easier to fix than a pandemic, because a pandemic, you cannot see it. It is very hard to control. The only way you can control it is by stopping people leaving their houses, having contact with people. You know, it's a very, very complicated situation. This is not complicated. Shark is in the water. You don't go in the water. Problem solved. And
yeah. And your business doesn't have to shut down unless you're doing boat rentals, basically.
Yeah. And even then, like, I mean, we've seen in this pandemic that a lot of businesses have had to find ways to adapt like really, really quickly. And yes, there are a lot of things which that is not possible. And obviously, those then are the people who do need help from the government, from whoever is in charge. And we actually had this conversation off mic before we started recording about the, you know, in the US it's been the stimulus checks, and that's been a sort of like a blanket thing that everyone has received, as far as I understand it. And in the UK it's been a lot more targeted, and so they've sort of had this furlough scheme where if people have been unable to work, the government has paid like a certain percentage of their wages and the employers have paid the rest and all that sort of thing. Obviously adapting, you know, majority of people have been working from home where they've been able to, and special measures and things put in place for those who haven't been able to work from home. So all of those things have been necessary in order to control this. So had they, I get that it's sort of like it maybe at this stage feels like a little too late, but those people are going to be coming anyway for the holidays. Like, try and do something to save August. Like, that is what Brody is suggesting. He's not saying, like, shut up this entire town, the summer is over. Like, this is, you know, deal with this problem now. And they literally said in the previous scene, like, when there is no longer food in the water or, you know, things for the shark to eat, that shark moves on. So this, yeah. I don't know how long these things take. This is when we need Jack to answer our shark questions. But give it, I don't know, like a week, couple of weeks, and maybe like a little bit longer just to be on the safe side. That shark is probably going to have swum off and found somewhere else to feed because the food supply has dried up. The food supply being the people of Amity. But Larry at this point is just willing to serve those people up as a buffet and doesn't really seem to care about the implications of that. But it's getting back to sort of what he says to Brody, like putting that on Brody is so harsh when, like, he is the mayor, he is the elected official in charge. It is on him to try and do something about this problem. And if the thing that he is concerned about is the businesses going under and money and all the rest of it, then that is on him to fix. Like, that is not Brody's jurisdiction. That's not his area. He is, you know, trying to keep the people of Amity safe, and he is trying to do that, but this is something that falls into Larry's hands at the end of the day, and he is washing his hands clean at this point. He is like, he's basically saying, I'm done. At this point, he's like, I'm done having this conversation. Make these waters safe. And I don't buy that there's nothing that they could have done to have helped the people of Amity get through, you know, a couple of weeks of not being able to have people go in the water. Obviously it would be a very, very different film if Larry just turned around and was like, okay, yeah, everyone shut up shop and we'll give you all a check for $2,000. Like, I mean, the film would be over and we would have no more episodes. But yeah, just the complete lack of logic or wanting to listen to logic from Larry is just it's hard when we've gone through something different but similar ourselves. I think it's hitting different.
Yeah, it's a lot different. Mm-hmm. So to sort of bring the scene in for a landing, I think there's one thing that we alluded to earlier that I really want to talk about right now.
Yeah.
Which is when Larry gets in his car and drives off, the background is doing a lot of work and it's really great. So in the background of the scene, there's a street sign that says one way, which is a pretty common sign. Mm-hmm. And then Larry drives off. I think that's such a great bit of visual storytelling that I've never noticed in this scene before, which is like, it's Larry's one way thinking, one way mind. Mm-hmm. Of we stay open and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that, but I also really like that there's a lighthouse.
Yeah, there is.
Right in the frame next to it. And a lighthouse is like a beacon of safety. It's, you know, it's there to alert people. And I think there's also a power pole that's dividing those two things. That's, mm-hmm. you know, there's it's coming between them. And it's also separating Brody and Larry in the frame into those two sections of the frame. So it's showing Larry as the one-way thinker and it's showing Brody as the lighthouse. And that is so good.
It's so good. Yeah, don't anyone ever tell me that Jaws is like just about a shark and is really basic, because I will show them not even a scene, just a still like this and be like, cool, well, let me tell you all of the things going on in this particular shot and why they are significant. It's so good. I think I've seen or picked up on that sign before, but just never like the significance of it like really, really hit in this scene. And like you said, the way the shot is broken up as well. And the first thing I wrote down in my notes was Lighthouse, because I've been hinting at this for a few weeks and I knew this scene was coming up. We've had sort of things similar to lighthouses, or, you know, we've heard, I wrote them down, but we had the, when they're doing the autopsy, the first thing you hear is the sort of the foghorn of a lighthouse, and then the torch that they're shining on the shark is, it looks sort of like a lighthouse. Then the searchlight when they're out on the boat looking for Ben Gardner's boat, again, looks, the way it's so dark in that scene that you just see this beam of light and it looks like a lighthouse, basically. And I think maybe, yeah, I mentioned on that episode or a previous one that I would bring all these things to a head when the moment arrived, and this is that moment, because in the background is a lighthouse, and like you said, it represents safety and is this sort of beacon signaling ships towards shore, but is also a warning to those at sea, and that's kind of how it's been used in previous scenes as well. Generally, that beam of light or the sound was before we uncovered something. With the autopsy, it was when they obviously discovered that Alex was not inside the shark. When they're out on the boat, that came just before they discovered that Ben Gardner's boat and what had happened to him. So here, yeah, right in the background, we have this, like, on the left-hand side of the screen, the beacon, the symbol of safety, but also warning. I don't think they can make that any clearer than they have than they have already. And maybe these things are all just happy, wonderful coincidences, and that's just where they shot that scene, and there happened to be a lighthouse in the background. But when you're picking these things apart in the detail that we are, these are going to be the things that we pick up on. And I just love that thread that has run through these sort of last few scenes that we've been talking about. I think is so good.
Yeah, and it's great that it comes to a head here. Like, it just shows how much forethought Spielberg puts into this stuff. Yeah. Like, you know, oh gosh, sorry, I don't remember who it was, but one of our guests was talking about when he was working on Columbo, Peter Falk said, "I've never worked with a director prior to that or since who thought so much about the shot selection." Yeah. And mm-hmm. you can tell mm-hmm. in almost every frame of this movie, like, it's so purposeful always. I had another friend who was posting that they were watching, I think, Minority Report for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I have seen Minority Report once, and I think it might be his best looking movie. Like, it, just in terms of the how dynamic the camera is without getting in the way. Like, it's so easy to do that kind of stuff and, like, be very showy. I'm looking at you, Birdman. And just, like, wear it on your sleeve, or even, wow, I'm really getting on a high horse about Inuyasha films, but, like, The Revenant, where they were like, "We did everything for real," and it's like, congratulations, you made a documentary, not a movie, then. Like, come on. And, like, it was all natural lighting, and then, like, Leo ate a real buffalo liver, whatever, deer liver, anyway, whatever. I didn't like that movie either. Anyway, but it, like, you know who you don't see talking about that is Spielberg.
Yeah.
Like, he's not out there boasting about the hardships of making Jaws. As a matter of fact, he shies away from it. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the big differences between, I don't want to say the imitators, but people who grew up watching his films and you know, being inspired by him, versus, like, I feel like they're all tripping over themselves to justify why their movie kind of feels the way it does. And that seems weird to me. Like, Spielberg just kind of lets the piece speak for itself. And then it's kind of better that way, because then you watch it and you realize how brilliant that stuff is.
Mm. Yeah, I think Spielberg not really talking about the making of Jaws that much. I think he is just, like, deeply traumatized by the whole experience,
yeah,
which is fair enough, because that was a grueling shoot. But I think the thing I love about Spielberg, and particularly in Jaws, And I think you see this in his early films as well. You get it a lot in Duel, which I think is a really underrated Spielberg film, is that he isn't that showy, but yet there's so much going on that you can dive into. And it would be a truly insane thing to do, but this is really making me want to go through like every Spielberg film minute by minute, just giving us podcast material forevermore. But because I'm just like, what have I been missing out on just watching this is now the ramblings of a mad woman. It's like, what have I been missing out on just watching films normally start to finish? Like, I want to watch every film in this truly, truly insane way, because I am picking up on all these things and noticing all these things, and it is just making me love my favorite movie of all time just that bit more, because I'm just appreciating these little things and these super subtle bits of visual storytelling. And you can't tell me these things are an accident. Actually, I changed my mind. I feel like there is some planning and there is some forethought into how these things are going to unfold. And the positioning of that, talking about this shot, the positioning of that sign and where Larry is and the lighthouse and where Brody is, it's so perfect. I don't want to think that is an accident. I know that sounds weird, but I like that someone cares so much about the subtle underlayers of those of their films, that this is something that they consider and this is something that is planned and thought out, because it just makes it have so much more impact. It really does. I truly want to watch every film like this now. And now I have no life.
I was, so you mentioned that and I was like, I'd be down. And then I was like, I don't know if I could watch Schindler's List minute by minute. That
God,
would just be
no, that's,
a bummer no. podcast. Like, I feel like that is not the vibe I want for any podcast.
No,
ever.
Truly not.
Yeah, I feel like that's like, are you trying on purpose to not have listeners? Because no one wants this.
No one
wants to listen to that.
Yeah, I could do it with Jurassic Park, I think, Close Encounters, Duel. Yeah. Like, there's a bunch I could do it with, but there's also some not very good Spielberg films. I don't want to spend a minute watching the BFG every week. That's not how I want to spend my life. That's not a good film.
Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Oh, no.
The BFG minute. That's funny.
The podcast no one wants.
The BFG minute. Man, I can't stop thinking about that. There's exactly one scene I remember from that movie, and it's the fart jokes.
Oh, no. I erased that film from my memory, and now that has brought it back, and I don't like it. I didn't like looking at
it.
You
know what? I would do Tintin Minute. I think that movie is so good.
I have not seen it, and Martin, previous week's guest, is very upset that I have not seen that film and keeps trying to make me watch it, so I will do it at some point.
Yeah, I'm going to be annoying about that the way you were about Scorsese. It's so good!
The name of the podcast for that writes itself as well. It's like the Tintin It, if that works. I'm just...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yep. Anyway. No, it is really good. It's really interesting too, because of the specifically because of the camera work stuff, because he's operating in animation and particularly 3D animation, he can put the camera wherever he wants. So it's really interesting to see him get these like weird, impossible angles on stuff, but still keep it very like Spielberg-y as far as like the dynamism, but also the subtlety of it. It's really interesting. It kind of makes me wish he would have done more animated films and would do more animated
Has
films.
Has he done other
It
animated?
Looks really great. I don't think he's directed any other animated films. I think the closest he's gotten is the BFG, which is, you know, mostly real people plus a big CGI Mark Rylance.
Yeah. I spent more time talking about the BFG than I would have liked on this podcast. Truly more time than anyone else has spent talking about that film since it came out.
Oh, Ready Player One is a lot of animation. Oh, but that movie looks like trash.
I hate that film. I hate it so much that it made me get rid of the book, which I previously really enjoyed. That film made me hate the book. That's how much I disliked it.
I already hated the book, so going into the movie, I knew it was going to be an uphill battle. And didn't win. It didn't win that uphill battle.
Certainly
at all.
Not. No. Nope.
Man, I really hated that book. And
I hate it now.
The movie is, yeah. I will say there's actually some good like camera work in the movie, but it looks like trash. It looks awful. But like the camera work in the race scene is super cool.
Yeah, the Akira bike is in that bit, right?
I think so.
Yeah, that's the only bit. Oh, and the Shining bit as well, which I was kind of like, oh, this is okay, but the rest I...
Yeah, that's the best part of the movie, and the camera work in that is really dynamic and great, but all the characters are like bad to look at. Like, they're all so ugly. And
yeah.
Like, it's not a good movie to look at. He's done this, I don't know, this is kind of devolving, but he's done this, like, weird soft lighting on everything lately that I really kind of hate. Mm. Like, I feel like his movies visually have taken a hit lately. It started, I think, with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, actually. Like, there's this weird 1950s soft lighting that he just has stuck with throughout since then. And it makes it look really cheap for some reason, and I don't like it.
No.
But... yeah, the trailer for West Side Story looked neat.
Yeah, I'm keen for that. I mean, I don't know why you would need to remake one of the best films ever made, but I will watch it just because I love musicals. And it's Spielberg, so.
Yeah, I've never seen West Side Story, but you know, I know its reputation, and I know that it's super well regarded. And the way I see it, I don't think Spielberg would just remake a beloved movie like that for no reason.
Yeah, I get that. But...
so I'm interested to see, like, why he would make that movie again. Like, I don't... you know, I just have a feeling that, like, he's got some reason behind making it. And I would like to see that. Also, there's some shots in there that are really great.
Yeah, I'm already... prepared for the Oscar race between that and Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights, and I am team In the Heights all the way, even though I have seen
neither
of those films, so I feel like they're just painting that Oscar narrative already of like, these are the two films that are going to be like vying for best picture, they're both musicals, and it's like, yeah, I can see it already.
Anyway, this is not about Jaws anymore.
We digress.
Did you have anything else about this that you wanted to talk about?
I think that's it. I mentioned earlier just the sort of the close or the PS on this scene of that look that is exchanged between Hooper and Brody is just really great. Just seeing Hooper sat on that rock looking real dejected and just irritated,
so
annoyed, everything else. He is, I want to hear the next kind of conversation between him and Brody, but the film does not give us that. So my brain can fill in the gaps, and it is a lot of F-bombs in there. It's the bit cut from the film.
Yeah, probably. It's probably why it's not in
Yeah,
there.
For sure.
Yeah, I don't have anything else. Thank you guys for listening. You can follow us on social media. You can follow the show at Jaws for a Minute. You can follow Sarah at Sarah Buttery. That's Sarah Sarah Buttery, Budderey. You can follow me at MJSmith891 on Twitter. You can email the show if you have any feedback. JawsForAMinute@gmail.com. Also, the DMs are open if you want to get in contact with us that way via Twitter. You can support the show. The easiest way to support the show, rate, review, share with your friends. Let's get those numbers up. Because we would like to, I don't know, see them go up. but we, you know, we thank you guys for all the support you have given us over these last 32-ish episodes. And, yeah, also we thank you if you've bought the podcast theme. We were tagged in a tweet this week about that. That is available for purchase, written and performed by my lovely wife, Kristen Falls. It's available on Bandcamp, and it's a banger. also popular with children, so keep that in mind. If you're tired of Baby Shark, this is the next evolution. Yeah. you can buy our merch through TeePublic and Redbubble. There is a link in the Twitter bio to do that. You can buy us a coffee. Once again, Linktree in the bio. We are having a contest. So if you donate, once we hit a certain number of donations, we will have a contest so you can win some merch. So your donation, you could spend $3 and potentially win some merch. Do that. Because we would appreciate it. and also you might get something cool in return. And I wanted to shout out a couple things. One, we talked about this with Jack, just the Pimiento research group. You know, we had talked about doing our part, quote unquote, with shark conservation and ocean conservation and stuff. And that is the organization that he works for. They're doing good work in that regard. So go give them a look and just see what they're doing. And then this caught my eye this week. I didn't talk to you about this beforehand, Sarah, but so I'm making an executive decision. But Ghouls Magazine, which our former guest Kim Morrison writes for, they're doing, it says, they had a tweet that says, "We are thinking of doing a little live event looking at horror films and mental health the week of the 10th of May." And they were asking if anyone would be interested and that they would love to know what horror film has helped you with mental health. I think we've talked about mental health a lot on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that's near and dear to both of our hearts. And so give them a follow and see what they're up to the week of the 10th of May with that. Because I think that movies can really help or hurt sometimes in that regard. So I think the more visibility we can bring to something like that and the more we can normalize talking about things like mental health, the better we will be as society. And so I wanted to bring a mention to that. Go support them. That's at Ghouls Magazine, Ghouls Magazine, and at Pimiento Group, Pimiento Group. Until next time, it's Jaws O'Clock Somewhere.